Welcome back to the Mel Kay Show. I'm very excited today. You guys ask me a lot who I listen to, who you should be listening to, and who's really out there giving information fearlessly, just dropping truth bombs all the time. And my guest today, I'm so honored to have on Jay Dyer. He is one of the people out there that has woken up masses and masses of people to what's really going on. Thank you for joining me, Jay.
Thank you. Glad to be here. It's an honor. Yeah, I was glad to meet you in person. And I heard your speech at the event. Thought it was really wild, really good, really based, really red-pilled. So I'm glad to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. It was so fun meeting you and your awesome wife. You guys work together a lot, and that's always great. And I have to say, I was turned on to you a long time ago. I was in Hollywood for 16 years. I worked in the business for 18 years. I lived right up there on Laurel Canyon on Sunset Crest for quite bit of that time. And cool. when your first book came out, my friend was like, "Have you seen this guy's book?" And I was like, "She's like, I think you lived up there." And I'm like, "Yeah, I did. I knew a little bit." But then I was like, "Oh my god!" And then I just became obsessed with your work.
Can I ask you what you did? What were you involved?
Yeah, I was a screenwriter. I mean, I am a screenwriter. Cool. So, nice. I went to film school at NYU, and then I kind of like worked, and then ended up in Hollywood and got stuck there in Hotel California until 2014. I packed my car with all my stuff and ran. So, as you know,
you were ahead of the curve because it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people left California like from that time frame. I had friends that like they went to Tennessee, they went to Ecuador. I mean, there was just like a mass exodus for years out of California.
Well, I wanted to ask you because you know so much about this. And I had a YouTube that got taken down because I had on Dr. Z too many times. So it was like one. They were like, "Okay, you're gone. No chance to come back." But I did do a bunch of shows on a bunch of this stuff. So first thing I wanted to say is, how I see it, because you really dug into this. I was out there. I went out in 99, and I knew a lot about the covert. I knew about, you know, Aleister Crowley and Anton LaVey, and really I lived right up there near Wonderland. I knew a lot of that stuff, but on the periphery, you know, kind of, but not really. You taught me more about it. But what I saw happen was it was very covert. And then around 2003, it went overt. And the people, the demons that run Hollywood started not caring that they were openly promoting pedophilia, openly promoting Satanism. There's actual, as you know, there's actual witches' covens with very famous actresses. There's like these parties that are real. And what do you, in your work, do you see something that happened in the early 2000s that changed the environment there?
That's a good question. I don't know about that specific date. I hadn't really thought about it because a lot of my focus was in the first book. I was focused, as you know, on like mainly just the big directors. So I looked at Kubrick films and I looked at Hitchcock and I looked at Bond films and Spielberg and AI and kind of like alien propaganda. Right. But I think that, you know, Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut came out right before that. And in that, you know, the theme of Eyes Wide Shut is pretty much trafficking and, you know, underage things. So maybe that was kind of a signifier of what was to come and what was to be put out there. So, I mean, I don't know how much Kubrick knew about that in terms of the future. I mean, he didn't live much long after that movie. So maybe there was a change in terms of what they determined would be the best type of propaganda to alter society. I mean, if you go back to Edward Bernays, the father of propaganda, he famously said Hollywood is the greatest engine for propaganda the world's ever seen. And nowadays that's kind of waning, I think, with the death of the studio system as it's kind of fading away. But you know, for so many years it was just something tied up with the military industrial complex, with the intelligence agencies, all the liaisons. And even in my view, beyond that, because as you mentioned, the covens and this kind of stuff with high level actresses, more and more comes out too that a lot of the A-listers over the years were also spies. I mean, that's a whole other element of it that people find fascinating, but they don't really know about. And, you know, I mean, I wasn't the first person to write about that, but there were some other academics that had written about it. And then ironically, I think I have this book over here now. the mainline historian for British intelligence just now put out this sort of whitewash book about all of the stars that were spies. This is like the mainline historian for British intelligence.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, you know, oh, so I thought this was a conspiracy theory. Like, if you go back to 2015-16, oh, it's a crazy conspiracy theory. It's not. I mean, this is how the world is run, right? It's run by these circles, these networks. And so, you know, I think that it's important to understand that. You know, Ben Affleck was in an interview not too long ago saying, right around the time of Argo coming out, he was like, yeah, Hollywood, the CIA, they're flip sides of the same coin. They're pretty much the same thing.
Right.
So, yeah, I don't know about that specific date, but, you know, there could have been something significant in the decision to push a whole new tier of, you know, cultural engineering with that stuff.
Yeah, I think so. In your face. There was also, I noticed the big change when they built the new Death Star that is CAA in the middle of Hollywood. Something really, really shifted at that point, too, in my opinion, just from being there and driving every day, being like, something is going on. Plus, they started, I think you're right about the Eyes Wide Shut. It might have been a signal because we all know what happened. And he showed them the cut. A few days later, he's dead. They take 40 minutes out of that cut. And then they put it out. And, you know, it's something you talk about a lot, too, is predictive programming. And it's funny, preparing for this, I looked it up. And Wikipedia is a total fraud. And it said that it was a ridiculous conspiracy theory, you know, and I'm looking at this and I'm like laughing. But can you explain to my audience that might not know what predictive programming is? Because it's absolutely real and it's absolutely been going on a very long time.
Well, on a basic level, it's just the idea that you can prepare people for what's coming through fiction, and what the end goal of that might be could be different things. You could try to condition people. You could try to, scare them. You could try to do different types of things. It's very similar to techniques in psychological warfare that are done in military, where you try to play mind games with your enemy in the battlefield in warfare. But from the vantage point of films as propaganda and as social engineering and social conditioning, there might be multiple reasons why you would do it. But I think that typically what happens is it's kind of a conditioning exercise to prepare people for what's to come down the road. And a lot of people thought that was really wild and preposterous until there was a FOIA Act that was done a couple of years ago. And I put it in the very beginning of my second book, and this dealt with the thousands of movies and TV shows that the Pentagon had paid to have messaging and propaganda put in there. So we know that on record this exists, and it's all the way down to really absurd TV shows like Cupcake Wars. The military was paying to have positive military messages put into Cupcake Wars. So those are the easy examples of it that everybody can, I think, maybe resonate with. And then there's more speculative stuff, like there was a professor named Elliot Gaines who wrote a paper many years ago about what he called semiotics and 9/11. And semiotics is just the philosophy of signs and symbols. It's a fancy philosophical term for that. And he wrote a paper about how many movies prior to the Big Nine event had imagery very reminiscent of or very similar to what would come in the collapsing of the, you know, the towers or whatever.
Right.
And so he theorized that there could have been a kind of preparatory propaganda element to that. There's many, many other examples, but that's in my view is kind of like a form of gaslighting and conditioning, where you put something, for example, in a lot of science fiction movies, like surveillance everywhere. And then the public is conditioned to accept it because they've seen so many films of this. I think that you could look at warfare, people being if you've seen thousands of acts of murder in a film, then you're conditioned to that as well. So those are some examples of what I think predictive programming is. And then there's more speculative elements, like, you know, do some directors have an esoteric occultic attitude where they think that they're kind of putting a spell on the audience? I think that's also possible as well.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's really prevalent actually in music, in the music industry even Hollywood film. But the one thing is, I do want to just real quick, because I didn't ask you before and I want my audience to know, your background is also in philosophy and behavior and all of that. Can you just tell for a second to my audience what your background is? Because it's pretty fascinating, because it makes everything you're saying that I'm going to ask going forward even more important for people to understand.
So when I was an undergrad, I studied film, philosophy, and history. And then when I went to grad school, they didn't have a full-on philosophy grad. So they had a combination degree. It was philosophy and English and lit.
Right.
So I was able to keep studying fiction and literature, film into grad school and tying it into philosophy, worldviews, and propaganda. So I got deep into the history of Ian Fleming and how he utilized the character of Bond as a form of Cold War propaganda. So James Bond is not just a, you know, stupid, silly spy thing. He's also a figure that's used during the Cold War to project the Western ethos. And that is kind of inadvertently how I tumbled down this road of getting into studying propaganda. So I was writing a lot of papers about, you know, the history of propaganda and how fiction uses this. And one thing that I didn't know that really kind of fascinated me when I first looked at this was the early British fiction writers like Graham Greene and these kinds of people, they would take, because they couldn't in the UK put things in the media, that there was no whistleblowing allowed. Right. What they would do is they had Official Secrets Act. So what they would do is write fiction stories about the real, what really happened. So some of those old British spy fictions are actually about real British intelligence operations. And really Ian Fleming was just continuing that tradition. And in my view, that's kind of where we get predictive programming from, is this older British notion of trying to condition people through fiction. And one great example of that, that's not necessarily spy stuff, but it's more so globalist propaganda, is the character of H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was a master propagandist, and maybe people know of him in terms of War of the Worlds or whatever. But he's more so important because he was part of the Fabian Society, and he was the guy who really created propaganda for World War One for the Brits, and he was the Bernays before Bernays. And one thing that they figured out was that you can condition people way better through fiction than you could through news and these kinds of things. And so think how many people have watched, you know, H.G. Wells stories and been affected by Island of Dr. Moreau or War of the Worlds or Time Machine, you know, any of these kinds of things, which are all forms of propaganda for his worldview, far more so than, you know, any kind of news stuff or books or whatever. So I think that Hollywood and fiction, resonate in that way. And that's what I was studying. And that's what I was looking into in undergrad and grad school. So that's my background. And then we just, all the other stuff that has happened, like TV show and all that, just kind of followed suit from the blog. I just had a blog, really, is what I did. And then I just started, I took all the essays and put them into a book. And then that became a season of a TV show. And then that turned into, you know, all the stuff that we do today. So it's a wild story, but that's the background.
Yeah. But the truth is, once you see it the way that you have, you can't not see it everywhere that they put it. So it's kind of like, you're like a detector of like, oh, it must be weird to watch like a movie. It's hard with people.
Yeah, we were joking that we're movie detectives.
I can imagine. I'll be like, that's a terrible shot, or they didn't need voice over there, or that's a weak script. And you're probably sitting there like, do you see that? Did you see that? That'd be fun. Me and Jamie and my husband should hang out and watch movies. It would be mind blowing. So the reason I wanted you to say that is because I have questions about a couple things. So you've talked a lot about the transhumanism predictive programming, and there's two different, one is a director and one is a producer that I look at. And I think, I mean, it's shameless at the level. Now is one of them is Steven Spielberg. You have a chapter about him. You talk about him a lot. I feel he was compromised before AI, but from the movie AI forward in Spielberg's career, everything AI, Ready Player One, and Minority
Report. Yeah.
These are things that right now the World Economic Forum is openly, especially Harari, and that means it's been going on for 20 years, is openly implementing into real life. And I am curious, what do you think of that? Because those movies now are chilling to watch.
Well, you know, PKD, Philip K. Dick, is another character that's interesting here because, you know, Spielberg is pulling from Philip K. Dick and some of those stories. And I think that Dick was, I don't think he was an insider per se, like part of it. I think he kind of went nuts and he went nuts because he was hanging out with Silicon Valley people. So even though he wasn't like a part of the system, He knew what they planned to do with Silicon Valley. And I think maybe that kind of freaked him out. And so he put into his science fiction all these dystopian themes. And then he, that's kind of what conditioned some of those Spielberg texts. So I think that they knew what the plan was a long time ago in the 60s and 70s for the metaverse and this kind of stuff. And, you know, you can find old like 80s, 90s PDFs from like the Air Force and military white papers that talk about the creation of a kind of matrix in the future where people would live in pods and, you know, they would be in these alternate universes, metaverse type stuff. So that was in the works for a long time. And there's a symbiotic relationship between people at the Pentagon, DARPA, and Hollywood. For example, if you read Annie Jacobson's book, Pentagon's Brain, about the history of DARPA, the last chapter, she talks about going to DARPA with Kathleen Kennedy and James Cameron. I can't remember. She lists some various directors, and she talks about how they would go and have these meetings with the people at DARPA. And it was like a symbiotic thing where they would suggest science fiction ideas, and then DARPA would suggest movie ideas. So DARPA also has a role in conditioning and trying to push ideas in Hollywood as well. Right. For transhumanism is the point I'm trying to make there. So I think that probably there was, I don't know how long ago, you know, we did a breakdown of Close Encounters by Spielberg. And I think that's kind of an important alien propaganda. Spielberg played a key role in pushing all the alien stuff. So I think that if you go back to there's a 1968 Brookings Institute white paper that talks about pushing the alien mythology on purpose for social engineering. And the purpose of it is to change society towards technocracy and transhumanism. So whether there are or there are not, I don't personally believe in aliens, but the story, the mythology is useful as a culture driver to change civilization. And that 1968 white paper says that. So that's what I would say is going on with, you know, H.G. Wells, Spielberg. If you look at that, one of the first big science fiction movies was The Day the Earth Stood Still.
Right.
Yeah. And some of the CIA actually consulted on that movie.
Yeah, and then they had a remake that was ridiculous.
That was pretty bad, yeah.
With Keanu.
Keanu, yeah.
Exactly. And then that a lot of people didn't see that Johnny Depp movie, Transcendent, and it is.
Oh, I saw it. Yeah, we did a breakdown.
Exactly what they're talking about. And I'm sitting there like, and my question is also to you is, because there's also a lot of movies that portray the CIA as I believe they are as far as they can get. So three I see as them showing you the CIA is not for good is Charlie Wilson's War and a lot of these guys involved. Certainly Air America and Good Shepherd. All three of these movies are telling the people that are watching them the CIA is not a force for good, yet they're put out by these people. Why would they do such a thing? To tell us a little bit and then not a lot? I mean, is it to say like you think you know the story now, but so now you feel good that you uncovered the CIA isn't so great, but that's only
I think there's levels of influence and control throughout various decades. So like in the 70s there was a lot more critical. 60s and 70s had a lot of films that were more critical of the establishment. You know, 3 Days of the Condor is a classic anti-CIA conspiracy story that I've always thought's a good movie.
Oh, yeah.
And then by the time you get into the 80s, there was this push by Reagan because of the Cold War stuff that he really ramped up Hollywood propaganda. And so he wanted the, you know, movies like Top Gun, Navy SEALs, these kinds of things to push militarism. And my guess would be that there was also sort of a ramping up of connection between Hollywood and the CIA during that period as well. I think that what happens is that as you get into the 90s, because there's so much close collaboration, and we, you know, this public figures like Chase Brandon, Milt Bearden, they're the CIA connects. And they even made a movie lampooning these guys. Like if you've seen Wag the Dog, the Robert De Niro character is playing one of those guys as sort of the liaison to Hollywood, telling him what movies to make, how to do them, what kind of propaganda to put in there. And I think, by the time we get up into the 90s and 2000s, there's a much closer relationship. We start to see it actually coming out that the CIA openly consults on and creates many of these movies. Yeah. Zero Dark 30, Argo. Oh, that's up in the 2000s, I know. But one of the first was The Recruit with with Pacino and Colin Farrell.
That's crazy.
And that one, actually, the weird part is that, like you said, that's one of those movies like you're talking about where the CIA handler is the bad guy, right? Al Pacino is the handler, is the bad guy. But I think what happens in a lot of the movies like you're talking about, what we, the idea that we get when we come away from it is like, oh, it's not a corrupt institution. It's just a it's got some bad apples and we'll weed out those bad apples. But it is, it does seem to be the case that the further that you go back, the more critical the movies are of the establishment of the system. But the more that we get into modern times, into the 2000s, especially, more and more, it's like, no, the, you know, the CIA is actually just making these movies, you know, like Zero Dark 30, American Sniper. I mean, they're all just basically products of, you know, the military industrial complex. So, the only thing I can think of is just that they allow there to be some stories of corruption within the system, because it just gives the impression that, well, we'll just weed out the bad apples. And, you know, it's not the whole system that's corrupt. It's just people that, you know, if we just, you know, continue to believe in the American system and we can weed out the corruptions, is kind of the narrative. We were just watching that old, do you remember Mr. Smith Goes to Washington?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I saw it.
That's a propaganda movie. There's there's a bunch of 40s propaganda movies, because they say in the reels promoting the movie, like, the purpose of this movie is the American democratic system. Right. Every man can change Washington if he so desires and goes and puts his mind to it. Go give those fat cats what for, right? The idea is that, number one, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. But right. The idea was that any man, every man can be Jimmy Stewart and can go change, you know, the system and throw out the fat cats. But it's not really that way, because we know the deep state was embedded even back then and before that. So a lot of these movies, I think, just function to keep the overall American mythos of America's not a democracy, but this idea that came, that started really with Wilson and the Wilson administration. But America is now this democracy. We're a democratic nation. We're a democracy. We're not, but that's what all that propaganda was about.
Yeah. And, you know, I love that period of time in movies. A lot of people should go back and watch the 40s, 50s, some of these, like Cukor you know, I love like His Lady Eve and His Girl Friday and all these Philadelphia story, because you know what, it's a different time in America. And I think there's a generation of children that don't even know that stuff exists. And it's just a different take. Also, even like it's a Wonderful Life, some of these, but like you're saying, those movies, especially in their trailers, are very like rah-rah pro-America, you know, join the whole war effort, you know.
Oh, there's so much war propaganda. It's crazy. Yeah. In the 40s and 50s. Yeah.
Yeah,
well, maybe not the 50s, but in the 50s, the propaganda shifts to Cold War stuff. But yeah, the 40s are a really fascinating time, because it was like all noir films and then these, you know, goofy comedies and the war propaganda. Yeah.
And it's in all of it. But that's now, I was saying the other day on a different show that I was on talking about propaganda as well, is like in the last 20 years, every movie, whether it's funny or trying to be funny or dramatic or whatever, there's always some reference to Russia being bad. You know, it's like they've been conditioning us for forever. And it like now I see it and I'll be like, why are they? It's just like an offhand comment in like an Adam Sandler film. And you're like, what? But now I see it. What do you make of, because now we're in the situation, which is fully a propaganda campaign that allowed it in Ukraine. And the propaganda is off the charts. And people that actually know what's going on and have a geopolitical stance can't even believe what they're getting away with, but they are. And what's your thoughts on the Russian propaganda after World War II? After the fall of Russia or USSR.
Right. Well, you know, to go back to Cold War time, Ian Fleming played a key role in this as well, because people don't know that way before the war on TERROR, I always think about being on YouTube. So I think
you can say it on Rumble.
Yeah, the war. Yeah, it's on Rumble, right? So before the war on terror began, so Hollywood started pushing the terror narrative in the late 90s with like True Lies and these kinds of films. And then after obviously 9/11, it gets really ramped up with the notion of the terrorists and all the movies that came out with Arab Terror. But before all of that, people don't realize that Ian Fleming actually was the one that prepped us for the war on terror, because when SMERSH, which was real Soviet counterintelligence, when SMERSH collapses, it becomes Spectre. And Spectre is in the Bond novels and in the old Bond movies, an international terrorist organization, right? So they're not located in any specific ethnic, you know, enclave, or they're not Russian. They're an international secret organization that has recruited from all over to do terror everywhere in the world, which ironically is exactly what British intelligence and, you know, Ian Fleming's crew were doing. But so they were prepping, I believe, for the future war on terror, which was actually dreamt up, in my view, by entities like the Rand Corporation. I think Rand Corporation planned out and structured and prepped everybody for the Cold War. I've actually lectured through the official history of the Rand Corporation by Alex Abaya. He talks about this. So by the time that we were getting up into the war on terror, the narrative shifts to Arab terror. But you're right that throughout the Cold War, obviously, they had to make it the Russian villain too. So we were prepped for the Russian villain for so many years. And now they've kind of recycled that, because we're in this new Cold War, which all the outlets say is, you know, due to the not just Ukraine, but, you know, Ukraine and all this stuff goes back to 2014 when Soros was pushing the color revolutions there, the Maidan coup, and then trying to get Ukraine into NATO and all this kind of stuff. The Russian propaganda is crucial, because I think that the establishment sees anything that is potentially a challenger to the Anglo-American or Atlanticist power block as a country, any country that can figure out a way to have a symbolic challenge. So what I mean by that is, if you read Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, in the first 300 pages, he talks about why the Atlanticist power block saw the Austro-Hungarian Empire and Russia as his two main rivals. And so he says that the purpose of the two world wars and the Cold War was to bog those powers down, exhaust them, and then get them to basically collapse, to be integrated into the overall global order. And with Russia, that happened by the fall of the Soviet Union after Brzezinski had hatched that whole plan with recruiting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan to fight against the Soviets, which would later become Al-Qaeda. So this, the same people that, you know, Brzezinski, the CIA, that had recruited and set up this anti-Soviet force in Afghanistan, just later flips in the 80s. And by the way, you can see go look up the pictures of Reagan with the Mujahideen, the freedom fighters, in the White House. There's these propaganda photos of him with Al-Qaeda in the White House. And you can go watch the Timothy Dalton era Bond films where he's fighting with bin Laden. There's like this total bin Laden cutout in, I think, Living Daylights. One of the two. And so he's Razik riding on horses and fighting with the Mujahideen. Rambo, I think Rambo 1 or 2 has the Mujahideen as well. And then it flips in the 90s where they decide, okay, now these are the bad guys that are the terrorists. And, oh, yeah, they did 9/11, by the way.
I remember, I think Ron Paul said, terrorism is a tactic. We can't have a war on a tactic. What is this about? What is this war about? And I'm sure you know about Wesley Clark when he was like,
oh, yeah, giving the Seven list. Nations plan, yeah.
He was like, what is this about? But what's scary, and then also I'm sure you know about the Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, Center for New American Century out like their death. It was
Project for New American Century. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you read it now, it's like, who agreed to this? And it sounds like they're from the Death Star and like they want to take over the world. Like it doesn't even see. I can't even believe this is a real document. A, the American people didn't know about it. And everything that's happened since has gone along with it. And yet we're fed again, propaganda, propaganda. And here's the problem now, Jay, I think more than ever, is that the American people refuse to look at ourselves. And all these things, all this stuff that's been done, all these endless wars, these color revolutions, this terrible policy, and the masses of American people, not people that watch you, and I don't think people that watch me, but the masses, you still can't say, but what about America? Like, what about what we finance, what we fund? And you know, I say to somebody recently, I said, do you know that the military industrial complex, we're giving them $700 billion to the Pentagon and DARPA and all these people. And then they also trade on Wall Street. So war is a giant business that benefits very few people. But why? I can't believe that the American people aren't more outraged at all that has been done in our name and with our money.
Yeah. And again, speaking of propaganda, we've been watching Ben Affleck movies, and I haven't seen Pearl Harbor since it came out. And we went back and watched it, which it's so over the top. It's actually comical and funny to watch. But that came out like a few months, maybe a year before the big 9/11 event. And if you remember the PNAC document that you're talking about, it says we need a new Pearl Harbor catalyzing event for a new phase of war on terror. And you go watch Pearl Harbor, and it's like so obvious that this was being put out as this is a great example of predictive programming. So before 9/11, we get this big catalyzing event. One of the other best examples of this is the X-Files spinoff Lone Gunman, which has the World Trade Towers being hit with remote control drones. And this came out 6 months before the big 9/11 event happened. So we see this kind of seeding of that narrative in a lot of fiction prior to 9/11. There were cartoons that had jets hitting the Pentagon and the towers. Iron Man cartoon from the 90s had this in it. If you think that's absurd that it would be in a cartoon, actually, if you go into the history of cartoons, do you know the Pentagon would consult on Pentagon and the military would consult on those 80s cartoons like G.I. Joe and Transformers? A lot of people don't know that, but yeah. And the reason for that was that particularly was G.I. Joe. G.I. Joe was so big in the 80s. I mean, I was a kid, guy in the 80s, grew up watching G.I. Joe as a kid. That's just military recruitment.
Right.
It's preparing you to, don't you want to fight? You know, don't you want to be in Black Ops when you get older? And what's funny is that when you go watch all these old G.I. Joe cartoons, it has MKUltra in it. It has geoengineering, weather warfare in it. I mean, it's just wild, all the stuff that's in it. And it even has episodes where Cobra's not really the bad guy, and Joe and Cobra have to team up against these other, like, so it's like the shifting narrative, like, you know, you can have a group that's your terrorist asset, and then that's your buddy, and then it flips. And I would add one thing on that topic. Where's it at? Just to hammer this home, that really nails this whole neocon narrative that you're talking about. So Miles Copeland, who is I love this book because it's important it's great to read all the global elite texts like we do and lecture through those, but it's also important to read actual spies on the ground and their biographies of what they did. And so if we read Miles Copeland's book, Game of Nations, there's some really wild chapters in here where he talks about what he was up to as a CIA consultant in first Syria and then Egypt during the Cold War. And he says that you might be surprised to hear that we utilize terrorists and terror networks. But he says utilizing terror is just part of the game of nations. In fact, he says terrorists are just losers that we play with finesse. So it's like playing them like an instrument to do terror for the CIA.
All right.
And then he says on the exact same page where he says that, he says, then we brought into Egypt Hollywood. Wow. And he says what Hollywood did was change all of Egypt's mentality and ideology. And here's the key point. You might say, well, they were in there to help Egypt and to industrialize and to make into a modern, industrial nation. No, if you look at the end of the book, he says, you might wonder, why are we doing this in all these countries? You might think we're there to help them. We want to make them have a better standard of living. He says, no, none of that. He says the reason that we go into all these countries, that we overthrow these governments and that we set up new regimes, puppet regimes, blah, 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 blah. He says, do you want to understand this? Go read the Rand Corporation, Council on Foreign Relations, and Bertrand Russell. And he says, they will tell you that the long-term goal is preparing all of these countries for a technocracy where we reduce the population. That's the only point.
When did that book come out?
So let's see. Miles Copeland wrote this in the 60s or 70s.
I mean, this is so crazy that we let it.
This is his memoirs for all of his black ops that he did in Syria and Egypt. So he wrote this in 1969.
Oh, my God.
By the way, the first chapter is about how they were projecting that they would be using supercomputers to war game all of these operations everywhere through game theory to ensure zero sum winning. So they were already planning in the late 60s to use game theory and computers to ensure victory in all of these black ops coups and whatnot. So that's how the world's really run, is by these kinds of people. And what you were talking about with the stock market and the gaming and the rackets and all that, you know, certain generals have figured this out, like Smedley Butler. Even I think General Patton, people think he might have been killed, or they tried to kill him too, because he figured out that, hey, this isn't actually about winning the war. It's about more wars.
Right.
And then when you destroy the place, you rebuild it. And that's where the money comes in.
Right. Exactly. And a lot of people don't know Zelensky spoke at the World Economic Forum in 2019, basically saying you can have Ukraine.
And did you see he just did a recent speech, unless that was an old clip, where he's like, oh, this is a great business opportunity. Right. Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
So in Professor Sutton's book, Wall Street and the Bullshit Revolution, he says the whole point of all of that revolution wasn't to bring in some equalitarian ideology. He says is that it was funded by all of these industrialists and elites in the West to have a new market. That's it. When the Bolsheviks took over, they would collapse and consolidate the power. Then the Bolshevik government would be in debt to the people who funded them. And then the funders could come in and just buy up Russia on the cheap and set up new markets. That's the whole purpose of all this.
Yeah, I'm creating sure you read John Perkins' Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He has a new one coming out soon about the Chinese economic hitman. And it's just such a racket. If the people knew, they would rise up and unite and say enough's enough. I believe it's just such a war against the propaganda. Well,
that's the power of propaganda, right? People think they're fighting for America. No, you're fighting for Pepsi and Coke and Subway, basically.
Exactly. Now, I want to ask you, because you delve into this, I'm very good friends with Kathy O'Brien, who was a MK Ultra survivor. She, the person that really programmed her was Colonel Aquino. And it's very, very disturbing for most people to understand that the head of our psychological operations for many, many years, Colonel Aquino, was also a open Satanist that ran the Temple of Set. But somehow that's true. And that incorporates Aleister Crowley and all of that. But you probably, I'm sure you do. He wrote a document called Mind Wars that was classified.
Yeah, I've read that. Yeah.
And that is now, I believe that we're in that. Because in that document that I've read through it, it's very, very chilling. But if you read it, he's talking about 2020, first of all. And he's saying that he could take that by that point with psychological operations, I guess EMP or, you know, mind control on different levels and frequencies and all of this, that we could topple a nation basically in no time, with no weapons, nothing, totally psychologically and behavior wise. Do you feel that that's where we are? Like that is what is going on here in this country?
Yeah, I think that is a key document. I refer to it often because especially when you get to the end of the document, you have to read the footnotes, because he talks about geoengineering, and he also talks about, like you said, frequencies and manipulating frequencies through EMF, ELF, VLF, all different types of frequencies that don't just do engineering, but they actually have a impact on the human. Because he talks about human beings and their cells basically being antennas. So humans are like walking antennas, and then the frequencies can affect negatively or positively individuals. And actually, way before he wrote that, we go all the way back to Brzezinski's Between Two Ages. And in Brzezinski's Between Two Ages, he writes about that too. He says that we can set up ELF, VLF towers everywhere, and basically through the frequency manipulation, either agitate or calm down entire populations. So I don't know 100% exactly what all the stabbies and everything in the last few years were about, but I would not be surprised if it wasn't that.
Yeah, and especially recently, because a lot of people don't know that this is not, I call it the O'Biden regime, because it's just Obama and O'Biden. And for me, I people don't like it, but I say, I believe both Bushes, Clinton, and Obama were all on the same team, and it was not for America, and never was. And there's a big part of that people need to really start understanding, that it's a uniparty and every man for himself. If you want your individual liberty, you better stand up and take it back. But at the same time, we have a situation now where in America, we are so divided. And I think a lot of it is that mind control thing. But for you, looking at it from your perspective, the division among us is greatly exaggerated, because I believe, I don't know how much the turning the Smith-Mundt Act around so that they could use propaganda on us in 2012. And I think a terrible guy, Cass Sunstein, was really involved. What's scary is Sunstein went from being the real truth minister under Obama to working at the World Health Organization at the TAG group when they rolled out, you know, COVID, and he was like a mind control guy already. But, you know, how do we deal with this? Because as long as the American people are playing into this, and we have millions of people that think that they're working for one of the NGOs that Soros or Center for American Progress or Human Rights Watch or Southern Poverty Law Center, any of these, there's hundreds of them that really they're just front groups for the controlled demolition from the inside out of our country. A lot of them are real communists that really run it, or globalists. Like, what do you see for our country right now? Because I try to bring people like solutions, what they can do. And I think as long as we're divided and don't see the enemy as a common enemy that we all are fighting for real, then people will just continue to be controlled.
Yeah, unfortunately, it is very easy to get people fighting amongst themselves over minutiae and things that don't matter or things that aren't the main issue. So that's the big challenge here, is figuring out how to have sort of a common front, I guess, to oppose this stuff. I don't know exactly what the answer is, other than that one thing that was encouraging was that, you know, even if you're like me and you do a lot of media and internet stuff, like, you don't actually see on the ground the people. Right. Like, I'm talking to a screen and I see, you know, 100 or 1,000 or whatever people in the chat. But I don't actually meet and know those people unless you go out and do events. And so we have been doing live events, and that's encouraging because you see all these people showing up. And, you know, to be at your event when you spoke and to see you up there red pilling, you know, thousands of people live, I mean, that was wild. And I was just, that was encouraging. So it is encouraging to see, no, actually, people are waking up. There's a lot of people waking up. The system is getting so absurd with its lies and with its contradictions that, and it always has to double down. It can never admit it's wrong.
Right.
It is encouraging to see a lot of people waking up, but I think that my approach would be to not live in the cities, have land, try to be as self-sufficient, independent as you can, have guns, have gold, have Bitcoin, try to have a garden and animals if you can, you know, be prepared for all of those kinds of eventualities. So that's the best I could say that, and, you know, trying to find a good church, spirituality, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, because you're also into that. And I wanted to also bring up, you have a great series on tragedy and hope. And I've talked about it many times. Though I recommend it to people as a book to read, you'd really, really have to want to read it.
That's a nightmare, yeah.
It's a beast. But here's the thing. When I looked into it, and I reference it a lot, and he was obviously very...
I mean, look at that thing.
I'm so jealous. I want to come hang out in your library.
It took me a long time to read this thing, and it was a feat. I mean, it put me to sleep a lot trying to work my way through this thing. I mean, it's really technical and boring, but it's worth it if you do it.
But you broke it down for everyone. So
yeah, I did. We did it. We did 8 lectures for everybody. Yeah.
Right. But here's the thing. When I look into him, first of all, he was at Georgetown, right? So he was in the middle of the whole thing. But a lot of people, when I do bring him up, you know, I deal with all kinds, like, I'm not right or left or anything. And I show up wherever I'm asked to speak, just because I want people to wake up wherever they are, whatever they think.
Yeah.
But when I talk about this book, there's people that are adamantly like, he's one of them. Like, he's writing that book, but he was one of them. And he liked that they wanted this top down government. Is that because a lot of people say, like, he was warning us, like they say.
No, he's not warning.
Yeah.
No, he says at the end of the book, he's like, this is the best hope for America, for the world, is the extension of the what he calls the global liberal system. But the irony is that the very middle chapter is about technocracy. So in the very middle of the book, he's like, we're going to have, you know, mega cities run by supercomputers. So no, he's 100% on board with it. He was the archivist and historian for the Council on Foreign Relations. This book reportedly was given out to CIA section chiefs during the Cold War to help them understand why the establishment was at times funding communists, right? Because it would be like, you'd have people saying, well, if we're fighting the Cold War, why are we giving money to commies and this kind of stuff? like in Albania, for example. And the book explains that there's a bigger game afoot.
Wow.
It's not so much about Cold War and communists. That was never really a huge threat. And by the way, Miles Copeland says that too. He's like, we were never really worried about Nasser and the Soviets, you know, in Egypt. That was never a big concern. But you have to kind of play these long-term games to get a long-term goal, which we're now in one of those late phases of that, where they're actually rolling out the technocracy that Quigley talked about. So, and no, I don't think Aldous Huxley was a good guy either. I think they were all part of the same circles and families and groups and societies that wanted to bring this in because they feel like that's the best hope, is to, you know, get rid of the dumb people and let them basically have the future. So, right.
Yeah, I use a quote a lot in my speeches from Rockefeller, where he says, like, surely a banker educated class is better than auto determination of the masses, you know, and surely. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Quigley's got whole chapters. Yeah. He's got whole chapters on depopulation and I mean, he's got a famous quote too, where he's like, a lot of people thought I was against this. He's like, no, I'm not against it. I'm for it. It's the greatest hope for the world.
But you know, it's interesting about you, but a lot of people don't know anything and they don't dig in and they only read headlines or Twitter feeds. So, and I was kicked off Twitter for 2 years and I snuck back on cause I didn't get my account back, but I have to tell you, that's a mind warp all on its own. I forgot for 2 years. I did much better work than I have in the last 2 weeks. This thing right now that we're talking about, though, really to me is really key, because there's also these families, people. JFK warned us about the secret societies, and he's not the only one. You did too. You do too in all of your work. But the bottom line is, people still don't want to accept that. When I look at, you know, you just brought up Brzezinski. Well, his daughter is the MSNBC host. His one son is the ambassador of Poland right now. The other one's running the Atlantic Council. And you're just like, it didn't stop. It never stopped. And I was talking to somebody yesterday, a guy that just wrote a new great book on JFK and the murder of JFK. And I was saying, it's like, at least from JFK, but you know, from your work way before, but JFK to now, it's been one cover-up after another cover-up after another cover-up. And then this bogus reasons for national security, which never has anything to do with us or national security. It has to do with covering crimes of our government. And again, but there's been no justice in a very, very long time, at least nothing real. Every investigation is like bogus. Go get Trump on his tax returns. Well, I'd like you to go find out what happened to Mena, Arkansas first, you know, or what happened with 9/11 or Fast and Furious or Benghazi. But it's like they keep going. And the whole concept of justice and accountability, I feel like we don't bring that back. And at least you're doing it. I'm trying, exposing to the people. But do you see any hope for like justice and accountability for these people? I can't believe that nobody's even asked Clinton about Epstein. He's been, none of the Epstein guys, you know, I've done whole shows on they've got taken down, but I did whole shows on, you know, the whole network that Whitney Webb covers and Wexner and Apollo, you know, what's the deal with justice and law people? I guess they'll go to hell. But in the meantime, I'd like to see them something here.
Well, Quigley says that in terms of national presidential elections, those have pretty much been control for 100 years. I'm not saying that. I mean, I don't really think they wanted Trump. I think that was one kind of anomaly. But, you know, Quigley, he was writing in the 60s when he wrote that book. And he's like, pretty much there haven't been any real national elections for 100 years is basically what he says. And he says that's because these really wealthy elite families had pretty much bought up. I think he says at the turn of the century, the wealthiest few families owned, he has some outrageous figure, like 60 or 70% of the country in terms of production, industrialization, and industry, banking, and media.
Yeah.
He says media was a big, big part of what they bought up as well. So, I wouldn't hope for any kind of like tribunals anytime soon. I mean, I guess anything's possible, but the main reason things don't change is because people don't ever figure out the real power. And actually, ironically, again, I don't mean to drone on about Quigley, but he actually has a chapter where he says this. He makes fun of the John Birch Society, and he's like, you know, it's funny because the John Birch Society is kind of right, but they're also kind of dumb. He's like, because they thought that they did realize that there is an international conspiracy. He's like, but they were so stupid that they thought it was in Russia.
Wow.
He's like, it's not in Russia. It's the wealthiest people in America.
And in the world.
But they couldn't say that because that would mean that the American system was a problem now. And then it didn't work. So you can't have that, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind of attitude. Right. If America's controlled by these, you know, a handful of zillionaires, right?
Yeah, which it is. I mean, people can't really seem to identify. I keep saying the vassal state of the District of Columbia is completely captured. There is no freedom there. And, you know, one of the big things, I'm glad I didn't know you did so much work in Durand, because I got to tell you, we give them the most money. The taxpayers fund that thing. And it's shocking how much has come out of that Rand Corporation, Brookings.
Oh, they designed the whole 20th century. In fact, at the end of the book, Alex Abaya says, if you want to give props to or critique America and its decline in the 20th century, if you think it's a good thing or if you think it's a bad thing, he says, either way, you can all attribute it to the Rand Corporation. They're behind the whole 20th century of what happened in America, whether it's deindustrialization, Cold War, you know, they're where we have gone is this exactly.
God, you know a lot. You must be fun to hang around with. I got to tell you, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I hope you'll come back. I want my audience to definitely follow you. You have a new book I want to just touch on real quick, of essays about philosophy. And I think right now a lot of people could use Going Inside, and it's a good way to do that. So can you just explain what your book's about? Because I think right now it's like, if people don't get that their individual liberty should matter the most, and that that is the most in danger, and they don't go inside and say, I got to do whatever I need to do, then, you know, I say, good luck. Like, I don't know what else to do.
Yeah. So yeah, first two books were Hollywood, and they're the ones that same publisher as Whitney Webb's book. And you can get those at my website though, if you want. Like, I don't like to support Amazon, but plus if you get it from my website, you get signed copies. So you know, those cover, like you said, like Hollywood and symbolism and film. And then the new book is really just a bunch of philosophical essays, which it's kind of all over the place, but it's a decent, I call it an educated person's introduction to philosophy. So you can get that one at the website as well. And then I have another big book that is all of my essays, if you want that, but it's a kind of a beast. It's like a 600 page thing. So it's
okay. I say it's an
educated. The Red Book. It's not Mal's Red Book. It's not Carl Jung's Red Book. It's my Red Book. But
parents should get that for their college age and high school kids.
I mean, it's got all the geopolitical essays. It's got all the philosophy, religious essays. No movie. All the movie stuff's in the movie books. But so those are my books. Yeah, you can find me at jaysanalysis.com. I usually host the Fourth Hour of Alex on Fridays. Not doing it today, but usually I do. We do live events. We have a live event coming up February 11th in Austin. So if you want to get tickets to that, you can. It's going to be a lot of fun. We do a 5-hour presentation of, there's comedy, there's other comedians coming, and then there's like lectures. Cool.
Great.
Yeah, we do lectures like in terms of what we talked about today. So it's kind of a big mix of all that.
Oh, that's awesome. I wish I was there. I would love that. Cool.
Yeah, well, we're going to do Hollywood too, I think. So we've done Nashville, Orlando, and now we're doing Austin, and then we'll do Hollywood.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm in New York City now, but I might, you never know where I'll be then. But I've been working with, you know, Brewer and Roseanne a lot. And like, there's a lot of people that have had enough and they're going to get
out. You should, get me on that speaking thing. I want to come speak.
Oh, I want to. I was going to tell you right after I saw you, because it is a really good topic. And we're doing Trump Doral in May, and then we're doing Vegas in August, and you would be an excellent addition. And you know what? We got to bring that information to the people. The reason I think your Hollywood books are so important is because everyone kind of knew it, but they don't know it until they read it. And then they think, right. Oh my God. And honestly, Jay, I don't know if you're seeing this, but I'm seeing an alternate decentralized Hollywood growing, and people all over this country. And a lot of my friends from LA, I left early because I couldn't stand the homelessness and the degradation and the juxtaposition between the uber wealthy and what was happening in Santa Monica and where I was in West Hollywood even. And it's gotten way worse. But what I do want to say is, do you see that that people are, I know, I've done Sam's show and other people, that there is a alternate growing that is outside the Hollywood system that I believe is taking on energy right now.
Yeah, we just did an interview, two interviews with Jamie Kennedy, you know, from Scream.
Oh, great. Yeah, I knew him.
And he was saying what you just said. Like, he was like, no, this is actually, you know, there's another, it's like moving away from this older Hollywood system that's going away. And so, and that's a good thing, right? It's a good thing for things to be moving in the direction of return to independent film and a return to the auteur and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that would be ideal because, you know, that's what I like. I've always wanted to do that kind of stuff. So there's no way that you can do that if you have our views.
No, I'll never be able to go back to
that. Right. Yeah, exactly.
And I was already at a point where I'd turn in a script and my agent would be like, you're going to have to put this in here and you can't say that. And that was like 2013, you know, the last time I had a sit down where I realized, okay, it's over. It's over, but it's a cult and you can't get a job there now.
Exactly.
That's working for them. So we're creating outside the means. So thank you so much, Jay Dyer. I hope to see you again. I'll talk to, we'll see if we can get you on our tour, and please keep in touch and let me know where I'll go anywhere that you're near me. Cause we travel all over the country. I've been in 22 states in the last 2 years. Cause I didn't want to stay. Wow. I didn't want to stay in New York City. So we just took a road trip for 2 years.
Well, how is it there? Is it rough or do you plan to move out of New York?
No, really. New York, I'm not even there. I'm in Florida right now, but it's a dystopian nightmare. And what's so sad is now they've brought in all the illegals. So any homeless people that were in the shelters are now on the street, and then there's no cops. I mean, it's a controlled demolition of New York. Plus, everyone should know, 15-minute smart city, the minute they shut down and we went into total lockdown, 2 weeks to stop the spread. Eric Schmidt, I think the most nefarious of all the oligarchs and billionaires, and Bill Gates and Cuomo come on TV in New York and tell us they're going to reimagine New York. I looked at Rob and I go, oh God, they sold us out. And from that day forward, when I tell you the surveillance, my building has an ESG score of D. So they shut off all of our gas for the next 8 months right now. And they're making it electric. We have no gas.
We're living in a movie. This is like dystopia movie. We're in it. Isn't that crazy?
People have to pay attention. It's happening in California and New York. It always happens there first, and it's coming for you. So take Jay's advice and go get some land and grow your own food and get some guns and gold. I mean, that's where we are.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for having me. It was an honor. Great conversation.
Thank you. Really appreciate it. Bye-bye. Hey guys, I'm here with Dr. Sherwood, and we are very excited about 2023, and we want you to be in your best shape, really ready to get out there and enjoy this time and really get out there, stand up, fight back, be involved. Dr. Sherwood has lots of plans for making you as healthy as possible. Thank you, Dr. Sherwood. Can you tell my audience what you got in store for them?
Absolutely. It is time in 2023 to reclaim our sovereignty, namely health sovereignty. So I want people to go to Sherwood.tv/MLK. We have a lot of plans that are there for people. They can get advantage of those and take the first action steps. But I want people to go check out our free bi-monthly webinar that you can register for, and you can see what we do, how we do it. You can meet my queen, my prime rib / spare rib, Dr. Michelle, all of that. And we work together to help you achieve your best health. So again, that is twice a month, our free webinar at Sherwood.tv/MelK. Put all that in there, just like you see on the screen right now. And we want to make sure that you get those webinars into your life, into your heart, into your mind. And we want to work with you so you can achieve your best health. And remember, let's get our health sovereignty back.
Exactly. And Dr. Sherwood has great programs to jumpstart this year with everything you need. Thank you so much, Dr. Sherwood. I will see you on the road.
Sounds great. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Hey, it's Andrew Sorcini at Beverly Hills Precious Metals. I'm here at the MLK Show. Last year, we helped so many patriots out there protect themselves against inflation with gold and silver. In 2023, we can show you how to preserve what you have, avoid further loss, and position you for greater things for your investments. So the best way for us to help you is for you to go to MLKGold.com, fill out the online form, and put in as much information about yourself as you possibly can. The more information, the more we can help you. So do it right away. The time is crucial as we head into central bank digital currencies. We can show you how to protect your 401k or your IRA, and the costs are minimal.